As I said in my opening, I did change the sermon from the original title, and that will be next week. About 53 years ago, when I started performing, speaking in public, I started out as a comedian, as a political satirist in coffee houses. I did not do mother-in-law jokes because at 15 and a half, I didn't have a mother-in-law. And so take my mother-in-law, please, just, you know, it didn't work at all. I did political satire. I looked at the world and at the great issues of life, of death, and tried to find a way of making people see those things and experiencing them differently. When you give a sermon, when you make a reasoned argument, a lot of people are sitting there doing their response in their heads. Or if you're here, they're actually doing their response out loud. When you do humor or when you do music, people are moved. It's a direct experience. You can say, that wasn't funny, but if you laughed, you better deal with it. And so that's part of the point, that humor bypassed some of the censors. And I tried to do serious issues. When I came back from the Peace Corps, from working and teaching and studying in Tunisia, and got to Berkeley in the 60s, I addressed in various venues the same serious issues, sometimes with humor, but always with some passion. And so Berkeley in the 60s and in the early 60s, my early comedy, which was influenced by Mort Saul, I didn't steal his act, I stole his attitude. And later on, I actually wrote him a line, which he used. This is good only for a certain generation here, which I wrote the line that I don't understand why there's controversy over a two-China policy. Nancy Reagan has at least a two-China policy, and it's all porcelain. So now I know all the people who are over 50, and apparently not as many as I thought. The subjects that I was addressing, my first sermon in a synagogue was Temple Beth Am, and it was about integration and civil rights. The first time I was arrested, it was at a fair housing demonstration in Huntington Beach, Torrance, in the 1960s. The first sermon I gave at a Unitarian church, Star King Hayward, that I later became the minister of, was the role of women in religious myth. And I remember one of the sentences was, "And so men put women on a pedestal, put the pedestal in the home, closed the door, and chained the gates." First volunteer work I did up in Berkeley was at Planned Parenthood and for a woman's right to choose, because this was pre-Roe v. Wade, and women had to demonstrate that they were mentally unstable in order to get a therapeutic abortion. I was involved with the Cesar Chavez and the attempt to have organized farm workers for fair working conditions. And of course, I was involved in the anti-war activities. With a degree in international relations and military strategy, with work in the Peace Corps, with graduate degrees in theology and philosophy, I could not stand on the sidelines while my brothers that I went to school with were going off to Vietnam with policies that I thought were ill-considered and futile. That when John Kerry came back from the war and said, and testimony to the Congress, how do you tell the last man to die that he died for a mistake? Those were words that resonated with me and called for acts of witness. So yesterday morning, I awoke with my heart beating, as if it were a drum doing a tattoo for us to march off to war. We were on the brink of launching an attack of missiles on another country that didn't attack us in order to teach them not to contravene international norms. We were going to contravene national, international norms by attacking a country that hadn't attacked us. We wanted to teach them a lesson that you have to kill your people the right way. If you kill them the wrong way, we're going to get annoyed wherever you are, and we're going to come after you. So the 100,000 who have died in this Syria civil war got some attention, but it didn't really become a humanitarian disaster till gas was used. Now, look, I am not carrying any brief for Bashar al-Assad or the use of chemical weapons. They're transgressive. Killing human beings is transgressive. War is a war crime. But we draw lines in very interesting and strange places about international norms. So we were ready to go off. All of the pundits said, yes, we're going. The signals from the politicians, including the aforementioned John Kerry, was, yeah, we're going. We're going because this is a moral outrage that changes everything. And I'm thinking, what the hell was Rwanda? Do people prefer being butchered with machetes? What was going on in Eritrea? What about the warlords in Somalia? What about the bombing of Aleppo and the slaughter of people from bombs? What about the napalm? No, it's only gas, or it's only chemicals, or it's only arms that have been sold on the market by us or by Germany or by Russia or by Czechoslovakia, not those things that you can kind of brew at home. Again, this is not a brief for using transgressive weapons. It is looking consciously at the choices that we make, because all of the passion was all of the passion that we've heard before. And it was with great haste. We got to do it, and we got to do it now. We got to do it now because this is the moral outrage. Well, we've known of at least 6 incidents of using chemical weapons there, and that didn't amount to sufficient moral outrage. But we got to do it now. We got to do it now, and maybe we'll let the UN inspectors get out in time. And we got to do it now because not only is it a moral outrage, but as Kerry said, filled with half-truths a couple of days ago, well, all of our allies say we need to do this. The Arab League says that Assad's a bad man. Yes, the Arab League does say that, but the Arab League does not say go and send cruise missiles in. The allies are all for us, but as our rhetoric gets more bellicose, as the war seems to draw nearer and nearer, our allies melted away. The English, most obviously. And all of a sudden, we're standing there having to ask process questions that Obama, when he was a candidate, was offering as part of his platform. It was, don't get into stupid wars. I'm sorry, he said dumb wars of choice. Only necessary wars. Colin Powell, don't go into wars unless you have an objective and an exit strategy. Well, we had an exit strategy, but no objective. We made a promise, we being the administration, that we would send these cruise missiles in against international norms without the support of the United Nations or of NATO, no Article 7 authorization, because they were breaking international norms. This makes my head hurt, and it made my heart hurt. We can argue nicely about what to do or what not to do, but the argument that we have to do something is a silly argument. I remember the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. I remember also when cut and run was a criticism of policy, and now it's our stated policy. Our stated policy is we'll send missiles in, but we don't want regime change. We don't want to change the flow of battle on the ground, and it is not our aim to end the civil war. Huh? So what is our aim? It's to send a message to Iran. As Samuel Goldwyn said, use Western Union if you want to send a message. Missiles that kill human beings in order to try to tell human beings not to kill each other or to kill each other in the right way makes everybody's brain hurt and should make everybody's heart hurt. Now, I'm not a pacifist. I've said that before. I've had, and this congregation has had, wonderful, brave pacifist members who did time, Tom Cooney being one of them, the late Tom Cooney. There are times when I think that you do have to fight, but you need objectives, you need laws, you need the upside to at least balance the downside. And what I woke up to yesterday morning had a tiny upside. Maybe it would get Assad's attention if we hit him not too hard and not too soft and gave him ample warning to move all the valuable stuff out of the way. That was the upside. The downside was it could trigger Hezbollah, it could trigger a regional war. The downside is we actually don't have any allies in the fight. We have Hezbollah and Iran supporting the Alawite Shiite branch of Assad. We have Sunnis and jihadis and al-Qaeda supporting the other side. And so we're going to get into this horrendous domestic dispute without a partner on the ground? There may be circumstances when we have to act, but nobody made the case to me. And just to puff my bona fides a little bit, I do have a degree in international relations, politics, economics, and military strategy. I did a master's in Sino-Soviet nuclear strategy, and incidentally a degree in theology and philosophy. These things seem to come together and say, what are we doing? Well, I don't know. But the good news is that over a course of a couple of hours, that drumbeat, that tattoo that was playing in my heart, started to slow down. When the president came out into the Rose Garden and said he was going to, he still wanted to go to an act of war, but not a war. This is a fine distinction. We have not had a declaration of war since World War II. So all of these other things that we've done about every 4 years, they're not wars. We have had two wars that our presidents have proclaimed, a war on drugs and a war on poverty. No wonder we don't declare wars. As Dr. Phil says, so how's that working for you? It slowed down. First with the British vote in Parliament, and protesters in the streets of Los Angeles and the streets of Orange County outside the White House chanting for peace. The Congress, across partisan lines, far right, far left such as it is, and libertarian, were all saying, what's the objective? What's the plan? What are we trying to accomplish, and how could this plausibly have a higher upside than potential downside? And so we're back to, we may end up, in my view, the wrong thing, but we're back to at least a process that Biden supported during the Bush administration and Obama supported during the Bush administration, which is to think about these things carefully, to have a plan, to get authorization, to have allies. This is important stuff when you decide that you're going to kill human beings, because sending missiles in will have collateral damage, and the definition of collateral damage is somebody whose name you don't know, but they're still mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, and children. It's to be done very carefully and intentionally. So I'm passionate about this. And I started to get upset. I started to get upset because, my God, what's happened here? 53 years of talking, of joking, but to a serious effect, I hoped, about civil rights. And civil rights are being attacked. About voters' rights, and voters' rights are being attacked. About union and the ability of brown people to organize, and unions and brown people are being attacked. About women's power and women's right to choose, and choice is being attacked. About war and peace, and the drums drum, and the situation is grave, and we have to make our decisions now. And so it feels sometimes like nothing has changed. God, I got to get depressed. But no. No. We made a difference in the 60s. We did eventually stop a war. We did empower women. We did win the vote and huge advancement for people of color. We have made great social strides in lots of ways. But JFK said, seemingly yesterday, that freedom is something that has to be won anew in every generation. So the fact that our gains are not set in concrete is true, but it shouldn't lead us to despair. It should lead us to engagement, to caring, to passion, to knowing that the choices that we make, the protests that we make, the unprotests, the things that we work for are not forever won, but they need continual time and continual attention. We should sing hallelujah that the world is not finished. We should lift every voice and sing that the world still needs us, our compassion, our passion, our engagement, our various moral compasses. We don't all have to be on the same side. We can analyze the situations very differently. But something very interesting happened yesterday on television, and I don't say that very often. People disagreed about what to do in Syria intelligently. They gave their different viewpoints. They cooperated and agreed where there was agreement. They didn't just create the false, I can't agree with you. They looked at it from different viewpoints, and they did it respectfully and seriously, and most unusually for television, I found, about particularly the Middle East, with real knowledge of the facts and the complexities on the ground. The need for people to be informed, the need for people to ask serious questions of ourselves, of our values, and how those get manifest in policies is as great today as it was in the 60s. All of the things that I marched for, occasionally got gassed for, once or twice arrested for, hit upside the head and in the stomach a couple of times, all those things counted at the time. They still count, and they're an inspiration that we, all of us, can make a difference, and a good difference, when we involve our heads and our hearts and our values in what we do in this world. The debate about which is the most important issue, is it voters' rights or civil rights or race or war or ecology, they're all important. Engage the ones that are given to you because of your own interests, abilities, and passions. Don't get caught in the game of this is more important, how can you possibly choose that? Engage the world. What I have said virtually from 53 years ago is my adversary is not the person who disagrees with me. My adversary is the person who doesn't give a damn, who doesn't get involved, who doesn't care, who it's too late. What are we going to do anyway? Let history just unfold. So when I woke up, I had mixed feelings. I felt a little bit like Rip Van Winkle. I woke up, I went to sleep sometime in the mid-60s. I woke up the next day, and nothing had changed except the technology, which I, nothing had changed in the human genome. Nothing had changed in our inhumanity or in our humanity. Nothing had changed until I tried to get out of bed and walk, and then looked in the mirror, but thank God my eyes are worse, so I can't really see without my glasses, and I can still say, well, you know, nothing's changed, really. I had a beard then, I have a beard now, and it's still red. The lesson is that time changes, but the great issues that humanity wrestles with of how to learn kindness, how to learn to share, how to learn to step back when we are hearing a bugle call that says, you got to do it, you got to do it now. When you hear that kind of haste, think about the TV commercials. Call now. Call right now. Operators are standing by. The first three callers are going to live forever. That's when the political rhetoric gets to be like that, it's time to say, whoa, Nellie. And there's another time reference, Dick Lane. It's time to say, whoa, Nellie, and step back from that brink and think about why the rush. We may have to do difficult things and make difficult decisions, but they can be done with process in an orderly and a compassionate and a rational basis. We may disagree with each other. That's okay, as long as we respect the inherent dignity of every age, of almost every opinion. I'm not going to be an absolute relativist here. And look at this beautiful, broken world and engage it in a constructive way, trying to heal our wounds, trying to staunch the wounds, trying to bring peace where there's war, to look for alternatives to violent reactions, to look at ourselves as others see us. And that's not always a flattering sort of thing. And so these are important times. They call for our reason. They call for our values. They call for our full and frank discussions of difficult issues that do not have easy and self-evident answers. They call for, and it's a difficult word, they call for humility. Having a sense that I have to do something, I have to think about something, but I might not be right, so I better respect you and listen to you, because this is real stuff. This is real stuff about what happens to human beings. And there is, in my value set, nothing more important to engage our hearts and to engage our lives and to create, if you are an existentialist, or discover, if you are an essentialist, the meaning that we create through our lives. And we do that as individuals, and we do that as families, and we do that in community. It is a beautiful world, and it is a beautiful day, and it needs us. And this is our time. This is our time to live, to act, to share, and to make a difference.